Welcome to Non-Fungible Rebels, a podcast where creators, tech, internet culture, crypto, and marketing meet each other. It's me, Annie Alexander, and in each episode, me and the Rebels will have a real unscripted talk, share genuine opinions, and show raw emotions. Should we start?
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to the Non-Fungible Rebels podcast. It's me, Annie Alexander, and today I'm speaking to Rizem. Actually, the interesting thing is, like, each guest kind of recommends someone else, and it becomes like a chain reaction, and I really like that because sometimes the space is so crowded and so loud that it's very hard to identify the real ones, right? So, I really appreciate the intro and the recommendation, and I'm very happy that, you know, we were able to make it. So Rizem, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you. I'm great. And you know what? I'm honored to be a polar reference too. Like, he's a cool guy. Like, he's really accomplished. And the fact that he thought of me was flattering.
Yeah, I mean, we had a brief discussion after our recording with Paul on the show, and I was talking about the fact that it's not always so easy to come across the people that I would actually want to talk to. And I described approximately who I was looking for. So he kind of, you know, every time he stumbles upon someone, he would just ping or tag and let me know. So that has been worked really good so far. So yeah, happy to have you over. We had a very brief chat on Twitter just before we kind of, you know, agreed to speak. And you said something that kind of resonated with me so much. You said, I'm all over the place when I was trying to kind of, you know, understand what exactly you do in the space. And I'm more or less the same. I'm wearing so many hats that it's very hard to explain in one very short sentence in terms of what exactly I'm doing. As a result, many people find out just one part of what I'm doing. So, and some people don't even have a clue what I'm doing. So, you know, that's kind of the caveat of that. But I feel like, it's also very exciting. So let's start from, I guess, maybe just starting from the very beginning in terms of your journey of how you discovered Bitcoin and how did you end up in this space?
Yeah. So I was a journalist when I discovered Bitcoin. I still kind of am a journalist. It's one of those things that you are, regardless of whether or not you're getting paid for it, it becomes a compulsion, you know? But I was a journalist. I was working at a organization called SiliconANGLE. They covered primarily enterprise technology news, the unsexy part of tech, you know? And I had a late night hang with one of my high school buddies who just happened to be, ironically, a vice president of Bank of America at the time, who was like, "Hey, man, have you heard this Bitcoin thing?" And this is in 2011. And I was like, what is this? And he kind of explains it to me, and I'm skeptical. And like a good nerd, I have my little netbook with me at the time. He goes, "Just install it. And I'll tell you what, you pay for dinner with cash and I'll pay you for my portion with Bitcoin. That way you'll have some to play with." And that's how I got my first Bitcoin. So, and I still didn't quite get it for a good couple weeks or so. Wasn't kind of grokking it until, you know, just something clicked. And my entire life have been an early adopter of technology, but Bitcoin was kind of the first, or blockchain was the first thing I was an early adopter of, where I kind of still was paying attention to it and was intrigued by it by the time the rest of the world cared what I thought. So, like, I was early to podcasting, and, like, you know, the early 2000s, I hosted like 70% of the world's podcasters on a free service. But by the time, you know, Mark Maron had figured out what podcasting was, or Joe Rogan, I've been out of it for like 7 or 8 years, you know. But blockchain and Bitcoin just endlessly fascinating to me. So I've been just doing everything in that world ever since.
Okay, sounds good. I think that happens very, very often, right? People discover it and then they kind of, you know, they just fall down the rabbit hole. And once you get the taste of it, you just don't want to leave. So, I can completely understand where you're coming from. So you discovered the tech, you kind of, you know, got fascinated, you stayed in the sphere since 2011. That's quite a long, long time for this kind of crypto years, for sure. I'm sure you've seen like the good, the bad, and the ugly, and everything in between. What kept you stay in the space? Because I've met many people who had these different periods where they were in doubt and they were really disappointed. They were thinking whether they should stay or leave. Eventually, most of them stayed, but you know, we all had these periods where kind of, you know, we were thinking about whether we should stick around or not. Did you have any doubts like that ever, or like, you know, you never had that?
No, I mean, you know, everyone has doubts about everything. I think the things that I doubted about it was less about whether or not this is something that's worth my time, and was more about something like, will it survive? Like, because in, you know, 2013 and 14, it wasn't clear that it would. There were some big body blows to Bitcoin and blockchain that, you know, it was not at all a certainty that it would make it out of that early stage. I mean, at this point, the only thing that has distracted me from playing with blockchain tech has honestly been AI. You know, it's the only thing that approaches that level of fascination for me. But I mean, obviously, I'm still in the space and I'm still doing things, so it's. I kind of view those things as complementary anyway. But yeah, like I think the biggest thing that may have like caused me to waver in my devotion to blockchain stuff would have had to have been just like whether or not I felt like it was accessible enough to kind of break through. I mean, like you're talking like 2013, 14, we're all using desktop clients. And we're talking about mass adoption for payments. I mean, those two things are so, I mean, we're still talking about like the hurdles that exist in the UX today in mobile interfaces and fees and that sort of thing. But looking back at that era, just understanding like, hey, you could, how is, no one's going to walk around with a laptop so they can pay for coffee. You know, like that was a big thing we had to get around.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I can imagine we still sort of, you know, have these burdens of onboarding, quote unquote, normies to actually open a non-custodial wallet. That itself is still not yet kind of, you know, completely straightforward process for regular users, right? So I can imagine like back in those days what it was like. So, you know, I know exactly what you mean. In terms of culture, because I feel like, you know, I have been around for about 7 years already, and although the fundamentals are the same, but like overall culture and the noise and the main sort of, you know, the loudest groups is periodically changing. The flavors are changing, you know, the style of communication is changing. There are always sort of, you know, different waves that dominate on the social layer. So how much do you think the culture has changed from that fundamental sort of principle of why this whole space was created up to now, or has it at all?
Oh, it's gone through massive sea changes. This is one of my favorite things to talk about. And it, especially whenever I do like public speaking is because I most closely identify with the ideology of like the founders of this space, like the cypherpunks and the crypto anarchists. Like I mean, you saw it in my bio, I crypto anarchists, right? Big, right in big letters. So, that ethos kind of goes through waves of dilution and like, you know, nostalgia readoption. I think, the first major contingency of adopters in the whole space was libertarians, which was some level of dilution of that kind of cypherpunk, because they're adjacent to crypto anarchy and cypherpunk ideology, but they're not, it's not an overlap of 100%, right? So that kind of took the stream of ideology one direction. And then I think the next big change was reactionary to the Ross Ulbricht arrest, was because when IBM decided they were going to bet the farm on blockchain and AI, it's like 12 years ago now, maybe a little bit less, 2015, 16. So the big influence in the space was like enterprise and fintech adoption. And the watchword was blockchain, not Bitcoin. And that was the only way you were going to get adoption, because, I mean, frankly, everybody associated Bitcoin and crypto culture with Ross Ulbricht's contingent, rightfully so. Like he brought the first major use case to crypto, but if you're trying to sell that to a guy in a suit, that's very difficult. And so that took a whole that took culture in a whole different direction. A big wave of, you know, guys in suits and kids in suits, you know, trying to differentiate themselves from any type of subculture at all. And then, you know, as time has gone on, this is from sitting in my perspective, this is also why I don't judge degen culture as harshly as maybe some of my contemporaries, is because for all of their foibles, it's that group of people that has brought us closer to cypherpunk culture, because they are disrespecters of the law. They exist in this like Wild West space, which is more adjacent to cypherpunk and crypto anarchy than anything IBM has ever done.
Okay, so culture wise, they are the closest, you think, to them.
Well, I mean, like, yeah, in a sense, like, and that's not universally true. I would have to qualify, but like, in terms of like a mainstream blockchain movement, putting air quotes around that because it's not really mainstream, but you know, like the big blob of uncontrolled non-thought leader people, that's closer to the ethical core of the whole thing than like anything that Oracle or IBM or any big companies would do. Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm happy they're involved in the space, but you know, they're not contributing to the culture.
Yeah. No, I totally get that, and I think for many the culture was what attracted us to the space, right? Because I remember even like in the very beginning, like just 6-7 years ago when I joined the space, there wasn't so much greed, and it wasn't, the conversations were not so much around money, maybe because there wasn't so much money to be made before the ICOs came along and all that stuff, right? Maybe that was one of the reasons, but like the conversations and the quality of conversations and also kind of, you know, the things that people cared about seemed to be completely different from what is happening now, right? So so I feel that that's what's changed, like the greed, the portion and the role of the greed in the culture and in the space and in the behavior and how people make decisions have increased a lot since then. But what was it like in the very beginning, like, you know, when you joined the space? Because probably it has been even purer, let's say. I don't know.
imagine Bitcoin maximalists that aren't quite as antisocial. That was okay. Like, okay, imagine being able to sympathize with Bitcoin maxis. That's the space. So, and this is why I don't judge them too harshly, even though I've said some stuff about them on my Twitter feed recently that this is kind of like judges them harshly. But the thing that you have to understand was there was an entire, just like now with like AI, right? There's this whole like crop of like grift fluencers that build their entire identity around hating AI. And there's still a little bit of that, like Web3 is going great. There's still a bunch of people out there that kind of do the similar thing about crypto. But like in the early days, I would say from 2011 to 2014, there was r/Buttcoin on Reddit. And it was basically anybody who just made their entire personality around hating cryptocurrency and Bitcoin. And it was essentially the Web3 is going great at that time, but it was a much larger group of people. And because it's Reddit you had three Reddits for crypto during that time that were prominent at any level. You had the Bitcoin Talk forums, which were separate, r/Bitcoin, r/BTC for the Bitcoin, became Bitcoin Cash people, and then r/Ethereum, which kind of moved off into Ethereum forums. But like that was the crypto community, those four places. And our Butcoin was like a quarter of the size of all those put together. And so it was just constant. All the rhetoric that seems like kind of like commonplace now, like, you know, like Bitcoin is a store of value and all these different things that are used to explain it. That was an exciting time because that rhetoric was being forged, you know, in the face of adversity of these haters at our Butcoin. And so at the time, I would say I probably identified with what we now call Bitcoin maxi culture, just because that was the whole thing, right? It was just a constant game of apologetics for crypto. That was interesting. And, you know, it was just over time, as other technologies have developed in blockchain, the paths have diverged. I find myself as somebody who enjoys exploring, seeing what other applications of the technology can exist. And a lot of them just decide to stick around for that one thing.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. And yes, I mean, sometimes the way Bitcoin maxis behave, I mean, anything extreme is not healthy, right? So I see where you're coming from. And you mentioned something that, you know, maybe we can just touch briefly on, you know, Bitcoin being store of value. I don't think that's how it was in the very beginning, right? Because I remember, like, we didn't think twice before spending Bitcoin as a currency and, you know, purchasing stuff. And, you know, I remember, like, I bought my first Nano Ledger back in 2017, paying for it with Bitcoin. Now everyone kind of, you know, wants to keep it because we don't want to spend it. And we're thinking that it's, you know, its value is going to keep growing and we just hold it mainly. How and when did that transition happen in people's mindset?
I would have to say it all probably was most cemented. I mean, because it was always a debate, right? Is this a store of value or a means of exchange? Or is it both or is it neither? You know, that was an ongoing discussion for a long time. But I think it probably cemented around the size, around the times of the block size wars. So BCH, BSV, at least in my mind, and I just had an interesting conversation with Joel Valenzuela on his, he held a Twitter space kind of about right after the Craig Wright, COPPA trial ended.
The court, yeah.
Yeah. And just kind of like, is BSV dead? And actually there has been some innovation in the BSV and BCH space, since then that I wasn't aware of just because I kind of stopped paying attention to it after it felt like the experiment was over for me. But this is kind of an existential question for all of blockchain to answer, because this is not something that's unique to Bitcoin. But Bitcoin, as it's currently kind of calcified, small blocks and high value and the distribution rate, it has to be a store of value. I mean, that's the fundamental question. You can't say it's a means of exchange if it's going to cost anywhere between $2 and $40 to do any kind of transaction. You simply can't. Like, no one's going to buy a cup of coffee that costs $40 plus $2. So the answers to that become, do you scale with L2s or do you increase block size? And it's interesting, we're having these debates all over again in kind of the EVM ecosystem, as we're, you know, experimenting with things, or in the kind of like, there's others like L2s and, you know, Solana, and everybody's talking about block size versus block speed and all these things. But if we look back to the history of the block size wars, we actually talked about this. We actually experimented with this, and we see what happens when you pull these levers and dials. BSV fell over as a network, right? So the 30-second recap of that whole era is, you had Bitcoin, core developers, some said we need to increase block size to make it a means of exchange and not just a store of value. Other ones said, no, don't screw with that. The ones that say don't screw with that are the ones that still stuck around core. Then you had Roger Ver and Craig that took it off the Bitcoin Cash, and they said, let's have a slightly larger block size. And then you had what I think is the most ideologically pure, like science experiment of this whole thing is actually the Craig Wright contingent. It says, well, why are we saying this arbitrary limit should be the limit for block size? Why can't it just be unlimited or really, really big? And those were the Bitcoin SV people. So they basically made it virtually an unlimited block size. And predictably, because they didn't adjust the incentives for operating a node, over the course of the next 2 or 3 years, the whole chain fell over because it was too technically complex to run a node, very expensive. And, if you're not getting paid for it, how are you going to subsidize its existence? So there's only like a handful of nodes still in existence for Bitcoin SV, which is effectively, a failed experiment, right? Because you only got a few nodes and not enough miners to keep the thing going, it's not going to be secure. So, this is why I think, along with people like Paul would agree with me, is like you need to kind of examine the history of where we're at. Stop trying to relitigate the past in terms of, oh, well, maybe we just increase the block size. No, we tried that experiment; it didn't work. Let's look towards other types of scaling, or just say it's a store of value.
Okay. Yeah, no, I get that. And I think it's very important to look back at the experiments and the history and what happened before, because I have a feeling that, these cycles are very sort of, very similar to each other. So, when you look at the ICO cycle and the DeFi summer cycle and the NFT hype cycle, and now the meme coin cycle and whatever is going to come next, they all sort of, are moving. They have different flavors, but like fundamentally, they are the same thing happening over and over again, us reacting to the things the same way, and then getting, acting the same way, and then making the same mistakes, and then eventually ending up with the same result of crypto winter. And then we survive it somehow, and then something else comes up and it restarts again. So I feel like, if people who join in every cycle, new people are joining. So, I've been talking to many of them, and I can say for sure, obviously I'm generalizing, but in most cases, they don't even get interested enough to read up or to talk to people or to understand what actually happened before they joined and what is all this space about. So they end up with very niche interests of that specific shitcoin or that specific community, and just they stick in their alley, right? But I feel like, if we did that, if we looked back and if you kind of, were curious enough to figure out and understand and ask people what actually happened while we were not yet around, I feel like, we could save ourselves loads of mistakes and probably speed up the process of just, breaking those cycles, breaking those patterns, and not repeating the same thing again and trying something else. So hopefully we would end up with some other results than the crypto crash and crypto winter eventually. So and I think that's the thing. The tricky part though is that, many people claim that should be done by education, but like, people have such short attention span. People are kind of, don't have enough time to dive into things too deep. People don't read these days so much. So education, sort of at its classic sense, I don't think dungeons have that culture or that lifestyle to dive into education.
I mean, it's an autodidact space. Like, the culture is teach yourself. So like, it's very difficult to have a unified curriculum. Which was, and I will say this, one of the benefits of that early Bitcoin maxi culture is like there was only like three sites on the internet where you could interact with other Bitcoiners. And so you got educated on the culture and what was going on, what worked and what didn't work really quickly. Of course, now, the blessing and curse is that we have a much bigger space,
Yeah, and I think as a result of that much bigger space and much more players into the space is that when someone comes in now, they are overwhelmed. It's so much harder to identify who are the real ones, who to learn from, who to follow, whose information is legit, right? Because like everyone is an influencer, everyone is the you know, I know it all kind of person, and everyone is very loud. So very often what they may end up with is, you know, coming across not the right sources, because the right sources are not so loud, are not so arrogant, you know, and are not so social media savvy, right? So I think there is a bit of disbalance here in the space about that. So, you know, it needs more effort from a person to actually dig deeper and do more research in order to end up understanding who to even follow in terms of information and knowledge. So I think that's the tricky part. I think we started by saying that kind of, you know, both of us are all over the place and do tons of different things in the space. But we didn't speak about what you actually do. What are all these different things that you're doing in the space? So maybe you can kind of briefly explain what all these different hats that you're wearing are, and then we can pick one and dive into it.
Sure. So just to go round the horn, so my day job that pays me is I'm a producer for a podcast network out in Dallas, Texas. It's a series of shows under the banner called The Merge, which is really just a kind of a gift from a friend of mine who had a little bit of a IP property, you know, that he had developed and didn't know what to do with, called me up and said, "Hey, would you want to do something with this?" And I said, "Absolutely. I don't like working for a living. Give me a video camera and a studio and I'll do some stuff." But so that's been fun. And I kind of joke. I mean, journalism is work, but it doesn't feel like work because I love it. But so that's what I do with most of my time. I'm also pretty deep into the world of DAOs. That's kind of where I've nested for, I would say, since about 2020 or so. Not exclusively, but particularly with social impact DAOs. I was kind of running the operations pod at Free Ross DAO for a couple of years. I was up until they finally kind of closed the doors on it a couple of weeks ago. I was the dev pod leader for Ukraine DAO from inception to, you know, almost present. Done a bunch of other smaller projects in DAOs. I enjoy making art and enjoyed the concept of NFTs. I actually know one of the guys that helped write the spec for it. So I got a really early look at what NFTs were. So I've been experimenting with NFTs in various ways, both inside and outside of DAOs, since more or less since they existed, maybe arguably before they existed.
So. Okay. Yeah. I had an interview with Dr. Nick, and we spoke a lot about DAOs, and I was sharing my initial skepticism about the DAOs in terms that it sounds really good in theory, but very often the way it's implemented, it's kind of, you know, it sounds like a DAO, but it's not actually a DAO. So there is a bit of confusion in terms of how you run it and, you know, who owns the government governance tokens and how decentralized it actually is and all that stuff. So, it also felt like, you know, there was this peak interest around DAOs a while ago, and then it kind of, you know, dried out a little bit, and you know, at one point everyone was talking about DAOs or creating DAOs, and then kind of, you know, that topic wasn't something I was coming across so often anymore. So what happened in terms of the interest change? Like, why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, I think it's not shiny and new anymore. Right. So I have actually created more DAOs since in probably the last 6 months than I have in the previous 2 years. But it's a little bit like because the tooling, all the tooling is no code now. Right. You can launch a Nouns DAO. You can launch a Moloch DAO. You can implement a Gnosis safe. these are all technically forms of DAO tooling. You know, anything that's multi-sig or better is essentially a DAO. And it's just for a lot of times for ad hoc things, or it's like, you know, whenever you register a domain name for an idea, you know, you, okay, well, let's go ahead and set up the multi-sig and the Moloch DAO or whatever it is, so that whenever this thing takes off, we can have the infrastructure ready. It's like registering an LLC. It's just not sexy, but it's there and it works, right? What kind of shifted in my mind, I guess, is not to think of DAOs as like some sort of like you put it on a pedestal and like you call it something and then like all these people are going to flood in and make it successful. It's more along the lines of, and it's helpful when you think about NFTs in the same way, just because all this stuff is just essentially contracts. They're agreements, right? But we've just codified them in a single ledger environment. And so if it's just a tool in your kit, you know, DAOs don't have to be successful. They just have to work, right? And for it to work, everybody that participates in it have to understand, first of all, where the buttons are, what the words mean, you know, so to speak, what the code means. And then as long as everyone's in agreement with what's on the digital paper, then it's just fine. It will always work as intended. But you have to understand, you know, what's going on. And that's not for everybody. Just like running a company is not for everybody. Like some people, their best bet is let's just file an LLC and run it as a sole proprietorship, or file a C corp and run it as a sole proprietorship and call it a day. And then some people, you know, like understand complex shell nested shell corporations and nonprofits and, you know, not you know, what's the new one, the B corp, that's like charitable but not quite charitable, and all these different things, right? These different structures exist, but they're not for everybody.
Yeah, no, I get that, and I also understand that there can be different flavors of different DAOs and the way you structure it, and you know why, like the purpose of them and why they were created and all that stuff. So FreeOps DAO, do you want to explain what it actually does and what's the purpose behind it?
It's pivoted a few times. Right now, it is a little bit like, it's the playground primarily for Shlomo Rabinowitz and myself. We were two of the main operators in FreeRoS DAO. So it originally was started because of the proposal structure that was implemented by the community in FreeRoS DAO. They didn't want to have ongoing commitments to salaried individuals. But we had like a half dozen basically salaried individuals that were running the operations in different ways. And so FreeOps DAO was basically a guild that formed to make sure that they had predictability and pay and didn't have to like keep writing a new proposal every single week to get paid for, you know, running the Twitter account or whatever, paying the server bills or whatever else was going on. So it was just kind of like an omnibus budget package that then was run through FreeOps DAO. When FreeRoS DAO wound down, we had some treasury left over. And so we've been treating it like a combination of a hedge fund and a kind of a social good fund. We funded a few like zines and prison reform initiatives and that sort of thing. It's kind of a private DAO. But, you know, we also have, you know, because we have expertise in writing governance and, you know, running things inside of a DAO infrastructure, we've been hired by, you know, other organizations, agencies, and DAOs to kind of, like, Futarchy DAO was this experiment that was a degen to DAO pathway is what they were trying to do. So they kind of hired us to write their governance for them, which was fun. We've also consulted on some stuff that had to, I'm not sure if we can name the clients involved, but there was like some big
name. Yeah,
you
don't have
like,
to. It's fine. Yeah.
But like, you know, like, so let's say it was Power Rangers or something, like it's something like that. Like they want to do an NFT project. So they come to us and they go, oh, well, how can you, what does all this mean? We just know we want to be in NFTs and we want to have like a community DAO type thing. Like, how do we do that? And then they hire us and we figure it out for them.
Got it. Yeah, got it. I just realized that because you know, I may have like loads of people who are not very sort of knowledgeable about the space and about all the stories, as I said, like, you know, because they happened way before they came into the space. Would you like to recap just shortly? I mean, we mentioned Ross several times and kind of, you know, the Free Ross DAO, and like, you know, we briefly touched about the story, but like we didn't really actually tell the story of Ross. Would you like to tell what happened and who was Ross? Because I think like that is one of those stories that everyone needs to know, because it's part of the culture and part of the space as well, the space history.
For sure. Yeah, no, I got really good at telling his story succinctly during my time there, too. So I'll give you the spiel. So in the early days of Bitcoin, there was no real application for it. But there was, like I said, a libertarian kind of anarchist culture that was early in the space. And so a lot of it was about coming up with ways to spend your Bitcoin in a way that was useful. So this guy named Ross Ulbricht, with a few other people, he wasn't solo, but he was the one of the kind of the leaders of the group, basically created the eBay for Bitcoin using a combination of technologies. One of the technologies is something called Tor, which is anonymized browsing. It's colloquially known as the dark web, and Bitcoin, which was the payment mechanism. So and so that you could interact completely trustlessly and anonymously across the web and buy whatever you wanted. He set down a few rules for his marketplace because he was of kind of the libertarian culture. He adhered to something called the non-aggression principle. So you couldn't buy anything that required force or aggression against somebody. So that means no explicit sexual, child sexual materials, CSAM, and no guns, no stolen goods. Anything else, completely fair game. And so what it primarily was used for, about 80% of the transactions on the site were used to buy, you know, personal use amounts of weed, basically. There are other things on there, obviously, as well. People were buying and selling fake IDs and, you know, a lot of people sell like documentation, like, you know, dark knowledge or whatever, mostly, you know, how do I scam credit cards, stupid stuff like that. People buying and selling identification, you know, stolen IDs has become very commonplace now, but at the time was not allowed. It became basically kind of a Wild West. He kind of backed out of it for a while and then was pulled back in through a series, basically a government sting, and was arrested in San Francisco at the age of 29. For operating it, through a long series of events, was then sentenced to double life sentence plus 40 years for operating essentially the eBay of crypto. Certainly less objectionable and more principled than the marketplaces for Facebook and Craigslist, and arguably safer. There's a lady named Kathy Reisenwitz who spoke and wrote about the case quite a bit, who said, here's a guy who essentially took the violence out of the drug trade. And, you know, the United States government martyred him. So as of, I think it was 2 days ago, he celebrated his 40th birthday. He's been 11 years in prison so far on this double life plus 40. And his only hope for reprieve is a presidential commutation or pardon. So that was what the organization Free Ross DAO was about. We were
because there was no parole, right? For his
It's the federal system, so you can't. There is no parole. There's no early release. You must serve 85% of your sentence, and when it's a life sentence, that's infinite, and it's an infinite number.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, I mean, it's just, but he still kind of, you know, he does have a Twitter account, and he still kind of, you know, tweets out and in interacts with his audience, right?
So that's managed by his mother. So like the way that works is she'll mail him like a bunch of selected responses and stuff like that from people that have added him or written to her and whatnot, and he'll he has a Medium and he has a Twitter account, and he creates a bunch of art as well, which is what Free Rostow is based off of, some of his art. And then so he'll email those back, or he'll use the CoreLink's digital mail system to send messages back to his mom, and then they'll get tweeted out.
Okay, yeah, I see. So how did you get involved with that DAO? Because, like, you know, you I know that you have your own story about this. Do you want to share?
I do have a little bit of a story, yeah. So I was working with an organization called the NCRI, the Network Contagion Research Institute, which is primarily a organization that looks at digital extremism online, precursors to terrorism, and reports on it, does long, detailed academic reports. I got involved with them because I was attempting to get leniency on my own case. Back in 2020, I was raided by the FBI for essentially using Bitcoin in a peer-to-peer manner. If you engage in any type of peer-to-peer transactions with any type of cryptocurrency, you are technically in violation, and you don't file a certain piece of paper with an organization called FinCEN, you are in violation of 18 USC 1960, which is the operation of an unlicensed money transmitter's business. It is not a very well-exercised right that the government uses there to prosecute people. They only do it in cases where somebody is prominent and or they're targeted for some reason, or they're looking at them and they like, oh, well, we spent a whole bunch of money trying to see if this guy committed a crime and he didn't, so let's just get him with this, like a opponent of his taxes.
Just to understand, does this mean that, like, you know, all of the DAOs who are US citizens are breaking the law using DeFi?
With DeFi, no, because it's peer-to-peer in this case is defined as people who interact with traditional finance or real meat-based transactions. So if you buy a stick of gum or a car with Bitcoin, Ethereum, Dogecoin, whatever, the federal government views that as something that should be a regulated transaction. If you use a Bitcoin ATM and that ATM is not registered with FinCEN, that should be a regulated transaction.
So basically anything that connects the crypto to the real life, more or less, like,
right,
in a simple terms, like anything that touches the real life and is not kind of licensed or registered or declared, that's when the issue comes from, right?
Right. Right. Now there are people in various levels of government that are trying to make that rule reapply towards DeFi, which is why Warren Davidson is trying to introduce something called the DeFi Regulatory Certainty Act. It's like a 10-line bill that would close the loophole on both FinCEN regulation on what I did, as well as DeFi, currently unregulated DeFi activity. But it hasn't gotten enough traction to make it into a law as of yet.
So you basically bought something with Bitcoin, a real life asset with Bitcoin, peer to peer.
I sold some Bitcoin. Yeah. So the burden lies on the person who is selling the crypto asset to register with the federal government. So if you buy something, you're not the one that's going to get in trouble. If you buy something with a real world asset for crypto, you're not the one's going to get in trouble. It's the person who sold it to you.
Okay, I see. So, and what was the punishment in that case?
I was sentenced to 15 months in federal prison, of which I served 7 in a minimum security camp and another 4 in an RRC south of Dallas. So, that was a whole other fun experience that we could probably do another hour on.
So, oh dear. Yeah. Well, I don't want you to relive the whole thing again, but it's just kind of, you know, I think it's important to sort of talk about this stuff because many people just don't understand the implications and the importance of knowing this, because, you know, no one might have even thought that this may may cause a problem, let alone a problem to such a degree, right? So,
I mean, one of the main reasons I don't run away from these discussions in my interactions on podcasts or Twitter spaces or whatever is because I was one of those people that didn't pay attention to, you know, these, what I thought were trivial criminal cases in the world of Bitcoin. Because I would read the same articles everyone else. So some guy in Miami got arrested for selling Bitcoin in an undercover sting to some cops. And, you know, they got him to say, oh, yeah, I don't care if you're buying a fake ID on the internet, whatever, that's not my business. And then he gets arrested and he has to go to prison. And then, like I said, you know, there's about six or seven of these cases every year. And if you look at the way the law enforcement writes the press releases about it, because as a victim of this type of persecution that I consider myself to be, some people may not like that I say that, but that it is how I think of it. When you're a victim of this type of persecution of the criminal justice system, you can't speak up for yourself. Anything you say to the press to try to clear your name is going to be used in court against you, or it will be used in your sentencing to lengthen your stay. Like if I had said, you know, I'm just taking this plea deal because they're extorting me into taking this plea deal, which they were, then the judge would have given me somewhere closer to 5 years. So, you know, I expressed the contrition that, you know, I was able to muster at my sentencing, but kept my mouth shut on Twitter. And I was lucky to only get 15 months. And that's the same with every one of these other guys. That's why the system is the way it is. It's why we don't have a lot of sympathy for people like me or Ross Ulbricht, is because the government, and frankly, SBF too, like he messed up in a lot of ways. He was not a good person in the ecosystem, but you know, you see what happens when someone tries to speak in their own defense. It doesn't work out for him. It probably made it way worse. That's why he's probably going to get a life sentence out of his case, is because all the stuff he said to try to, you know, build a bridge to the community and say, I'm sorry, and things, you know, I messed up, was used against him in the trial and sentencing. You know, and it didn't help his case that he also committed the fraud too. So like he actually did do the bad things. I'm not trying to defend that, but him speaking up for himself definitely made it 100 times worse. It made it an unwinnable case.
Okay. I see. Yeah, I mean, it's. I think it's important for people involved in this space to basically know the basics of how the law works as well. Because I know that, you know, we started from the very beginning, from those roots of kind of, you know, the anarchists, the libertarians, you know, people who kind of are against everything and want the, you know, free thinkers and freedom fighters and all that. But unfortunately, like, you know, I think imagining or kind of betting on the fact that that's how the world will work and that's what they are going to get as a new reality is a bit utopian. And, you know, we know that's not how it's going to work. So I think, you know, being involved in the space, one should know what they can and can't do, which is very gray area very often as well. And it's not very easy to understand which are the limits, because the regulation changes as well. And it's different for different countries, for different citizens, so it's very hard to navigate. But I think that at least the basics should be covered, because very often people may end up doing stuff without even knowing that that's something that, you know, can't be done, right? So and I think the dangerous part in this space specifically is that we have big masses of people doing things that can't be done or are not supposed to be done, so it becomes kind of the new norm. So you may not even like have this notion that it may be unlawful or, you know, or against the law, because everyone else is doing it, and it's a big amount of people who are actually doing the same thing over and over again, and no one has been punished yet, right? So I think there is this risky part in the space just to take into account, even like the simple things like, you know, the price speculations and the price talk and promoting a shitcoin on Twitter, which is like basically the legend's lifestyle. That's most, for some of them, that's the only thing that they do 24/7, right?
But they should all learn about a guy named John McAfee.
Yeah, how many of them actually know that it's, you know, they can't do that, right? So, and also this illusion that if you're doing something like that and you just have a cartoon avatar and don't have your real name, it doesn't mean that you can't be identified eventually, right? So I think that these all these illusions as kind of misconceptions of the whole thing based on the on what's happening in the space and based on looking around and seeing how others act is very dangerous, actually. And I know I'm kind of, you know, being this party pooper and kind of, you know, not being in line with that whole kind of, you know, anarchist philosophy. But yeah, I feel like, you know,
I think you're right in line with anarchist philosophy. I mean, like, for me, I know I'm a radical. I know I'm out there and I don't expect everybody to... I'm content in life knowing with even in the face of knowing that most people disagree, even people close to me disagree with my point of view. It's okay. I get it. I'm out there, but I'm out there trying to blaze a trail. And I think people that think like me would actually agree with you with what you're saying, because, you know, first of all, I feel like the more you know about how this all this stuff works, the closer you're going to get to thinking my way of, you know, philosophy and ideology anyway. But second of all, you know, just because it is considered illegal to go out there and do degen stuff with a cartoon avatar on Twitter doesn't mean I'm telling you to stop. I think you should just know what you're doing and what lines you're crossing so that you are able to take whatever precaution. If you're going to still do it, take whatever precautions you need to take, right?
Yeah, you know, like, but at least know what you're doing, right?
Like, exactly, exactly.
That's the thing. At least know that, you know, you're not, like, you know, it's against the law, and then make your decision to still go ahead and do it if you decide so, like, you know. But I think my main worry is that many people don't even know this, you know,
right.
They don't even, like, you know, when I talk to them, like, oh my god, like that tweet, like, looked very dangerous or whatever, they would say, what do you mean, like, everyone else is doing it, what do you mean dangerous? And I'm like, well, it's against the law. And they're like, what do you mean? What law are you talking about? So I feel like, you know, there is this mismatch of, you know, one thing is making the decision and making a choice, knowing what it is that you're getting involved with. It's another thing of not even sort of, you know, having this vague idea that, oh, maybe there's something wrong with it. Let me check it out, right? So I think that's where the mismatch comes from.
I mean, and the other thing that I would say is that, a lot of the people within the DOJ and the lawmakers and regulators certainly don't really care what the actual law is. Once they have decided to go after somebody, at least this is the United States. I don't know how every other country's, you know, law enforcement culture works, but I'm pretty intimately familiar with American law enforcement culture at this point, sadly. And once they have somebody in their sights, we have enough laws and regulations on the books in America to put somebody away for whatever, right? So if you have made an enemy of somebody in the government, or if you have been, you know, if you're of a certain influence or visibility level, that should absolutely impact how you behave and what you say and what you do. Because that was essentially what got me in the eye of Sauron for the government, was the fact that I did not obfuscate my identity in any way. I had this column that I wrote for SiliconANGLE called Ask Dr. Bitcoin, and that it evolved into, you know, a video series, and I, you know, put it in my bio and you saw it there. And so I also, whenever I got into doing OTC, which I've been doing since 2011 at various levels, but like during the pandemic, I spent a lot more time, you know, at home. And so I was just like, okay, I'll sell Bitcoin. I don't have to go out and work in an office somewhere. And, you know, as I made that into my primary business, I used my brand name, Dr. Bitcoin, that was associated with my digital identity. And so it put, you know, it was just a too easy of a way to put a spotlight on myself. And so once I was in the spotlight, I was done. I was cooked. So that is the, I mean, if you're not going to advocate for the space or pay, you know, attention to anything else that we say on the subject of regulation and law, I think that's probably the most important lesson to learn from this, is once you're in the ISR and you're not getting out. So absolutely watch how you handle your digital privacy. online and watch how, if you're not going to watch your privacy, watch your mouth.
Yeah, or both.
Yeah, but, I mean, yeah. Ideally both.
Yeah, no, I see. So I guess we're reaching out towards 1 hour already. So let's kind of, you know, look ahead, I guess, to wrap things up. Like, you know, I mentioned briefly that we're kind of, it feels like we're going in cycles and we keep redoing the same thing, getting the same results. It's kind of, you know, this is the third deja vu for me. I don't know how many you had by now already, but what are, like, if you think about the future, like, how do you imagine it? Will we keep circling around like forever, or like, you know, what needs to trigger a change, I guess, or like, you know, what's going to happen in the future? How do you envision this?
Well, the one thing I've been taught by my experience here is whatever I envision the next epoch will be driven by is probably wrong. It never fails to surprise me where the innovation comes from. So just to give you kind of a concrete example of that, there's a gent named Cody Marks Bailey, who his name is not on the spec, but he was part of like the working group that created the EIP at one of the ETH, I think ETH Barcelona or something like that, wherever they wrote the ERC 721 EIP. So like as soon as he came back from that, he was like, I got this. I was talking about tokenizing real world assets or something that was vaguely related to that. I was like, I don't even know how I'd do that. And he goes, well, it's funny you mentioned that. We worked on this thing and I think it's going to become a big deal. And so that sent me on I spent the entire ICO cycle instead of making money. I mostly was pursuing NFT related stuff. I mean, I was doing other stuff too, but like that was like my main focus. And focusing on NFTs, I wasn't looking at art. I mean, art was kind of like art provenance was like an idea that we all had, but mostly I was looking at enterprise applications because, like I mentioned earlier, this is the era of IBM, blockchain, not Bitcoin, you know. And so we were thinking, okay, so how can we apply this to supply chain? How can we do that? We were focused on creating an ecosystem for data oracles so that we could have reliable, you know, real world asset tracking for IoT, kind of merging those three spaces together so we could have reliable NFTs for real world assets. Still hasn't been a solved problem. And so whenever kind of the next bull cycle comes around, you know, after kind of like a DeFi summer, and then as you know, with like NFTs start to become big in the art world, or, you know, digital art, it totally took me by surprise. I was like, wait, we haven't solved like the big problems yet. Like we haven't got data oracles fixed. We don't have IoT fixed with blockchain. How are these people able to understand like where the provenance is if anybody can just mint something and there's no authority or trust or whatever? And they're like, I don't know. We like monkey JPEGs, man. I don't know what to tell you. So that's kind of it took me by surprise, and that's going to happen every single time. And I think it feels like the next emergent thing, I'm probably wrong, but the next emergent thing is going to be transactions. And none of us in the West are really paying attention to it as much because we wrote Justin Sun and a Tron ecosystem off pretty squarely a couple cycles ago. But if you talk to anybody from Asia or from, you know, South of Central America, USDT on Tron is really big. Because the fees are low, and it's withstood a ton of regulatory scrutiny and still is standing as a stablecoin, and it's a better alternative in Asia for people that need to interact with the West than using traditional banking rails, and for people in South of Central America, in certain regions, it's better than whatever the local currency is because they're experiencing hyperinflationary events. So I think, you know, it feels like something's going to bubble up out of that. That's going to take us all by surprise. I could be wrong.
Yeah, it's again, in this space, as you said, it's very hard to make any predictions. And I think that's the beauty of the space, right? You know, you keep being surprised. Although it's kind of, you know, you have lots of things that repeat themselves, so you can identify the deja vu moments, but also there are like things that you can't really explain. And you know, as you mentioned, the NFT hype cycle was something very unexpected, and there were loads of things in terms of numbers, in terms of volumes, in terms of, you know, the perceived value of some things that, you know, it was almost impossible to explain. So probably something else unexplainable and surprising will be coming. We'll see how it goes. But I think, yeah, I just feel like, yeah, in our conversation, the main takeaways that I would like to for the viewers and listeners to have is basically that idea that they should go back and check out the history and the culture and what happened before. And we covered some of it, but obviously there's tons of other interesting stories to look into. So just to get curious enough to actually sort of go back and look at stuff, because it was exciting back then as well. So it's not only now, you know, it's been excited along the whole journey, and obviously we covered the regulation and the laws. They are changing, they are getting stricter, there are lots of things to take into account. So just, you know, when you're doing stuff, at least know what the implications might be, because we don't want all this to happen to you guys. So I guess that's kind of, you know, the two big takeaways, and I will include in the show notes the links, the link to your link tree, so people who are interested in the DAO, in your art, in everything else that you're doing, your articles, it's all there. I went through it last night while, you know, looking into this podcast. So tons of stuff to dig into, the Ask series as well. So in terms of education, there are lots of information and knowledge there as well. So just, yeah, tons of stuff to dig into if you're interested in more. And I guess that was all for this week, guys. Thank you so much for coming. I really enjoyed speaking to you.
Thank you for having me.
That's all that I've got for you today. If you want more of my content, please check out my newsletter at annealexander.com/subscribe. And I'll see you in the next episode.